disperse immediately or you will be subject to arrest with my help.
A boss ain't nothing but a thief on a time loan. 128-bit war, you play Nintendo on some shooter, so put the bridge down and feed us to the killer bees. We get what we deserve, life. Bury me with my MP3s. Write my manifesto in 72 DPI. Life's just a game, you got cheated, never learn. I write these songs for every bridge that ain't been burned, for every cop car that ain't been turned.
Welcome to This Is America, April 22nd, 2021. On today's episode, we speak with Kiernan, president of CWA Local 7250, a longtime organizer in the Minneapolis area, about how rank-and-file union members kicked out the National Guard from a union-controlled labor center building. We talk about how the National Guard on the streets number in the thousands, their long history of attacking strikers and putting down rebellion, and much more. We then switch our discussion, where we talk and analyze about the latest string of mass shootings across the U.S. and the push for gun control by the Biden administration. All this and more, but first, let's get to the news. At the time of this recording, the Derek Chauvin trial has now ended, with Chauvin being found guilty on all counts. Immediately following the verdict, marches and gatherings took place in Minneapolis, New York, and in other cities. In Minneapolis, the scene was largely celebratory, with people gathering in George Floyd Square. Looking back on the past year, we should all remember that it took a mass social eruption to force the state to bring Chauvin to trial, because it knew to not do so would be even more costly for them. Already, politicians and pundits are lining up to talk about justice being served and the system working as it should, while the state moves to crush the social forces which made this moment possible in the first place. Let's not let them do that. Although Chauvin has been found guilty, across the U.S., National Guard troops are still on standby, ready to put down another round of uprisings. In Minnesota, there is currently over 3,000 National Guard troops stationed there. This is more than are placed in Iraq or Afghanistan. This buildup is part of the Operation Safety Net, a massive counterinsurgency operation that has been launched to put down a potential rebellion in Minneapolis and other places following the outcome of the verdict. In response, resistance against the Guard and the overall repressive buildup has been growing. On this episode, for instance, we talk with the president of a local union about how union members pushed out the National Guard who were attempting to use their union building as a staging area. Students have also been organizing walkouts from their classrooms at local schools against the presence of the National Guard and the recent police murder of Dante Wright. There have also even been reports of people taking shots at the National Guard in their vehicles. For more information on this resistance, see our recent article linked in our show notes. Against the backdrop of the Chauvin trial, thousands over the past week have also continued to bravely stand up to the heavily militarized police and National Guard in Brooklyn Center, only miles outside of Minneapolis, following the police murder of Dante Wright during a traffic stop. The officer who shot Wright, Kim Potter, has since resigned and was arrested recently on second-degree manslaughter, although they now have posted bail. If convicted, Potter faces up to 10 years in prison. To stay up on protest coverage at Brooklyn Center, follow Unicorn Riot Online, who is reporting live from the ground with daily updates. Also in Columbus, Ohio, people rallied outside of the police station there last week, forcing their way through a set of double doors that had been secured on the interior with handcuffs. An Ohio State University student from Northwestern Ohio was arrested for supposedly hitting a police sergeant with a wooden club. Sadly, on this same day as the Derek Chauvin trial also came to a close, police shot and killed another person in Columbus, Ohio, a 15-year-old African-American, sparking a new round of demonstrations. Meanwhile, in Portland, Oregon, resistance remains fierce as hundreds took to the streets over the past several nights in a militant standoff with police. On April 13th, a fire was set outside of the Police Association building. According to local news, police arrested one person the next day in connection to the fire, claiming they were working with an informant within the crowd to identify the suspect. Days later, protests and clashes with the police broke out in the middle of the day after police shot and killed Roberto Delgado in a Portland park. Later that night, clashes continued with protesters and police, and they ended with the corporate store being set on fire in the downtown. A White Army drill sergeant, Sergeant Jonathan Pentland, has been charged with misdemeanor assault following an altercation in which he was videotaped harassing and shouting at a younger African-American man on a sidewalk within a set of suburban tract homes. Pentland was seen telling the man to walk away multiple times before pushing him and threatening him with violence. In response, a large crowd gathered outside of his home and held a rally in which a window and light fixture were broken. In a historic walk-off, Teamsters and ILWU Local 63 members shut down one of seven major terminals at the Port of Los Angeles in solidarity with striking truck drivers. As already mentioned, in St. Paul, Minnesota, workers helped give the boot to the National Guard who were occupying a labor hall during the ongoing Dante Wright protests. Workers, quote, went to the hall and demanded that they leave. Stay tuned later in the program for an interview with a union member about this story. A bus driver in Brooklyn Center refused to transport protesters who had been arrested by police and turned their vehicle around rather than be an accessory to repression. Tenants in Houston, Texas that began a rent strike following the deep freeze that we covered on several podcasts back are continuing their strike and now are demanding from management better conditions at their apartment complex. In Oakland, California, tenants and neighborhood councils hosted a march on an Oakland slumlord who had attempted to evict a renter during the pandemic. Meanwhile, the struggle against the Line 3 pipeline continues with ongoing lockdowns, marches, blockades, and protests outside of banks that are involved in funding the project. Resistance against ICE also continues, as the Biden administration makes it clear that it's continuing many of Trump's policies as migrant detention camps grow in size and new ones are opened, and governments across the Americas beef up border militarization. Resistance to ICE on the streets is continuing. In Portland, a rally outside of the downtown ICE building started fires on the outside of the building, and in Long Beach, at a building that will be used to detain refugee children, was covered in anti-ICE graffiti slogans. In so-called Montreal, riots against curfews imposed in the face of the COVID-19 pandemic have popped off. The curfews have been an attempt by the state to put the boot heel on the working class and poor who already are on the front lines of the pandemic and having to work through it to survive. Instead of helping people meet their needs directly, it simply criminalizes movement in a person's day-to-day activity, a move that will obviously be informed and impacted along lines of race, gender, and class. Finally, in so-called British Columbia, an active 8-month direct action campaign with active blockades that started in August of 2020 to prevent road building into the headwaters of the unlogged Ferry Creek watershed is calling for solidarity actions as frontline defenders face possible mass arrests. So far, blockades have utilized tree sits, tripods, and other obstructions, and masses of people simply occupying the road to keep loggers out. To stay up on the action, check our show notes for links to the Ferry Blockade on Instagram. And now for some upcoming events. May Day is fast approaching, and there are May Day gatherings on May 1st in Rockford, Illinois, Cleveland, Ohio, and Denton, Texas, where people will be holding events with free food, zine tables, and local speakers. Please check our show notes for more information. And if you have an event on May Day, please get a hold of us and we will list it on our show notes. And if you value What's Going Down as a revolutionary autonomous media resource in times of crisis and you have the means, please go to itsgoingdown.org/shop. Again, that's itsgoingdown.org/shop. And sign up to become a monthly supporter. You can give us a one-time donation on our site or through Bitcoin. You can also tell a friend about us, listen to us on the radio, follow us on social media. And if you enjoy this show, check out the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network for other great, amazing content. Thanks again for listening. Let's get into it.
Also, it's always good to knock out Nazis. Like, what the f***? Like, why having a discussion about that?
Like, yo, did y'all do history? Y'all went to history class, right? You didn't just skip the shit and go play ball in the gym?
Yo, your father, like, your great-great-grandpappy probably has a box full of Nazi ears that he cut off.
Fuck you and your death threats.
Come shake some motherfucker.
Talking tough on the internet.
But in real life, you a sucker.
So what, you got guns?
That don't mean shit if you ain't gon' bust them.
So what, you got guns? That don't mean shit if you ain't gon' bust them.
Life in the depths of abyss where the light don't exist. All we know is the dark. Shit can get deadly like mixing the fatty up with the hair on in your arm.
Whole lot of gunplay while I stay. Uber Eats pull up in your driveway. Knock his ass out, he a Nazi. But he starts singing like Beyonce.
Fuck you and your dead friends and your dead kin. Do something about it. I see walk on your mama grave. My crip homies taught me all about it.
I ain't gang banging, rapping red or blue. I'm in all black, my fucking troops. Black block, attach your body to your laptop. You gon' fucking boom.
Air out the room, mass murder. Too many bodies and not enough purses. Oh, I could remix up the pack and then serve you with battery acid and Leo ass burning.
Ooh, stop saying what you won't do when you won't do. Like, ooh, check your ass like 1-2. Check 1-2, motherfucker.
Fuck you and your death threats.
Come shake some motherfucker.
Talking
up on the internet.
But in real life, you a sucker.
So what, you got guns?
That don't mean shit if you ain't gon' bust them.
So what, you got guns? That don't mean shit if you ain't gon' bust them.
Ooh, I hear you talking that blah, 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 blah. Ooh, acting tough with that rah, 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 rah. Ooh, I don't give a fuck. Nah, 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 nah. Ooh, guns start to butt ha, rah, 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 rah.
Bitch, I'm from the north.
Lending me the area.
We don't fuck with poor.
CPD don't really care for us.
Smoking like a pour.
Yeah. Fuck around, we bury ya.
Murder is a sport.
In the middle of America.
Touchdown from the uptown. Where they cutthroat, buck rounds. At you fuck clowns. You don't want smoke. I roll with some anarchists. They do not obey the law. Big old fat banana clips. Stuff them in collision cars.
Tell me really what you won't do. Citizens SJW.
Fuck boy, we got guns too. It's the art of war and I'm Sun Tzu.
Fuck you and your politics. You a pile of shit and it's obvious.
From the post you make, you a snowflake. How you going hate from the posthumous?
Fuck you and your death threats.
Come shake some motherfucker.
Talking tough on the internet.
But in real life, you a sucker.
So what, you got guns?
That don't mean shit if you ain't gon' bust them.
So what, you got guns? That don't mean shit if you ain't gon' bust them.
Ooh, I hear you talking that blah, 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 blah. Acting tough with that rah, 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 rah. Ooh, I don't give a fuck. Nah, 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 nah. Ooh, guns start to butt. Ha, rah, 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 rah.
He was like, yo, I'm banging Nazi. Yo, however, he said it was alt-right. You know, he rebranded it. He was like, cool.
Still Nazi shit, my guy.
All the magazines was on his dick talking about, look at the dapper Nazi. Alt-right guy gonna change the world. And someone in the street was like, nah.
Nazis are so handsome.
He was like, no, we're gonna knock you the fuck out.
Yeah.
So my name is Kieran. I'm a longtime anarchist, anti-fascist, and labor organizer activist in the Twin Cities, Minnesota. And recently I was elected president of Communications Workers of America, Local 7250. And in that role, our union is AT&T workers mainly in Minnesota. Also in a few other neighboring states, but mainly Minnesota.
Let's talk about what happened. If you want to describe it, there's a building that basically different labor unions use, and the National Guard, and we'll talk more about kind of like the scope of the National Guard deployment in Minneapolis and the surrounding towns and stuff in a little bit. But basically, they are understanding they were utilizing it. There's video of them like inside the building. And people basically showed up and you know, made them leave. So let's talk about kind of like what happened. How did this play out?
You know, like you said, there's more to say about the National Guard. I think, you know, the big thing is that the Minneapolis uprising from the murder of George Floyd hasn't fully been quelled. You know, there's still embers that have been going all year long. And then with the murder of Dante Wright, there's a new sort of like popular street militancy that's happening in Brooklyn Center, and people are out on the street. And at the same time, because it's coming at the time of the Chauvin trial, the trial of the cop who killed George Floyd, the state had already been mobilizing around that. And one of the things they've been doing is this thing called Operation Safety Net, where they are backing up the local law enforcement and sheriff's departments with 3,000 National Guards troops in the Twin Cities area. So I'm saying all that to say that the presence of the National Guard had started to become more noticeable. There's like armed vehicles and soldiers in many places around the city and in multiple cities of the metro area. And, you know, so it's becoming a thing people are becoming more sort of like aware of and also anxious about. And then there's also been all the repression that's been happening up in Brooklyn Center, where there's just this ton of tear gas, especially, has been fired, but also rubber bullets and markers and, you know, mass arrests and macing and arresting or detaining journalists. So, you know, kind of all the repression is starting to be very noticeable by a lot of people, especially people that are, you know, active in the movement and are watching stuff. And as you probably know, the movement here, it does have a mass quality and still has a mass quality since last year. It's not just a handful of activists, right? It's kind of lots of regular people who've been politicized and energized and become militant out of the conditions around us. So this is my long answer to your short question, is that a number of people noticed that the National Guard had set up at the Labor Center in St. Paul and became very concerned about that, because that's the sort of the headquarters for the East Metro or St. Paul and suburban labor unions. And so that was kind of the context. From there, a number of people wanted to figure out what was going on. So after work hours, a few people went over there to see what was what. And I was one of those people. And I went over there kind of expecting to see what I've been seeing all over, which is like, and what we saw last summer, which was maybe, you know, a small group, you know, two armored cars and maybe six or seven soldiers sort of set up in the parking lot. But instead we got there and there were 17 armored vehicles, including some really, you know, big type of vehicles that look like the kind of vehicles that they used to roll through the townships in South Africa to spray people, right? It's got this turret on the top. And about 50 or more soldiers camped out inside the labor building. And so the St. Paul Federation of Labor is like a coalition of all the different labor unions from the East Metro. And our union is one of the members of that federation. And we were never asked about this. And asking around to other unions and union activists that I know, we couldn't find any other unions that were asked about it either. So we're trying to figure out how the hell did the National Guard get permission to set up in the labor center like this. And so we went over there and kind of, you know, demanded to know who would let them be there. And, you know, after going around and around a bit, we got the information, a name and a phone number. We called them up and found out that one local union and one local union president had turned over basically the keys to the building to the National Guard. And they were starting to use it as a, like, you know, a little base area. And obviously this was a problem for those of us that have been sympathetic and active in, you know, the movement for justice in the Twin Cities against the police killings, against police repression, and those of us that were concerned about this military mobilization of the National Guard. So, you know, we called them up and we're like, yo, man, this is unacceptable. You don't have a right to make this kind of decision, you know, for the labor movement. This is controversial to say the least. And none of us had any option to discuss or let alone vote for it. No, none of the members did. None of the unions did. And the executive board of the St. Paul Regional Labor Federation hadn't voted on it either. So, This was an undemocratic, an invalid decision that you made. And myself and some others, you know, gave him a firm, you know, polite but firm scolding for his sort of jumping over the democratic process. And to his credit, he came down there. You know, he said, give me a few minutes, I'll be down there. He came down, he talked to us, and again, we told him firmly that we thought this decision had to be, that it wasn't his to make, so it had to be overturned. And he went in and talked to the St. Paul Regional Labor Federation president, and then they talked to the guard, and the guard packed up and left. And by then we had a couple dozen labor activists from probably about eight different unions, officers, rank and file people, and staffers. And, you know, it was pretty jovial mood to having forced the guard out of there. Now, you know, people were chanting and celebrating when the guard left. The whole time we were waiting, though, in this process, and we were kind of organizing, you know, we were rallying, but we were also having conversations with the guardsmen. And some of us did this last summer, too, when they were deployed after George Floyd was killed and after the uprising in Minneapolis. And, you know, personally, I view them to have a sort of different role than the police. I don't look at them the same as the cops. Now, they're part of the repressive apparatus of the state. There's no doubt about that. But they're also, they kind of have this dual role, because they're also, you know, working class folks from all over the state who are in this military situation. And traditionally, you know, soldiers are much, have a different role and also have a different attitude towards popular rebellion than police generally do. It's very rare to find the police ever siding with popular rebellion. While it's not unusual at all to see soldiers showing sympathy for popular rebellion. So my attitude is always to try and engage with the National Guard. I mean, that doesn't mean I take shit, or if any of them are being fucked up, that I don't say anything. And it also isn't make me fuzzy about what the role is of the Guard as an institution during this Operation Safety Net. But there's this lie that's being put out by the right wing that we were sort of, you know, hippies spitting on the troops, that kind of lie from the Vietnam era. And that just isn't the case, you know. I had a couple of interesting discussions with people, you know, talked about where they were from and what their impressions were of being there, and told them where I was coming from. And it's interesting. They just have a, you know, some cops actually did show up at one point, and it's just noticeable how the different interactions are. The cops come in very arrogant, try telling you, you know, what you can do and what you can't do right off the bat, even before they even know what's going on in the scene. You know, they're just, you know, they act like assholes. And the soldiers were more, you know, inquisitive. And I'm not saying they agreed with us or that that they were supporting what we were demanding, but it was just a different dynamic.
Is there a sense of, I mean, I'm sure it's all over the place, but is there a sense of where they're coming from or what they think about this? Because, I mean, like you said, I'm sure a lot of people, when they sign up for the National Guard, they probably weren't thinking like, oh, they're going to send me to some suburb to shoot, you know, right, a 22-year-old that's angry that their friend got killed by the police.
Right. I think that's absolutely right. Last summer we spent, you know, I kind of had some more strategic discussions with the Guard. We went around purposely to have discussions with people that were, you know, set up inside Minneapolis. And at that time, our main goal was to kind of really express to them why people were so angry at the police. Because most of them were not from the Twin Cities. Most of them, the ones we met last year, were from up north, from small towns in northern Minnesota. Now, Minnesota is a, you know, most of them had spent time in Minneapolis, had come down to, you know, go to the mall or go to a baseball game or you know, whatever, for whatever reason. Minneapolis and St. Paul is a place people from all over the state come fairly frequently. So it's not like it was totally foreign territory to them, but it definitely wasn't where they were from or necessarily where they were comfortable. And I wouldn't say that people like were in open sympathy for us. There was no, you know, rebellion in the National Guard, but one of the big things we were pushing is you got to understand why people are so mad about the police, and, you know, because of the conduct of the police and people growing up under this over years and years and years, that they just had enough. And a common reaction we heard from the Guard last summer was, well, yeah, that's obvious. I mean, you know, the third precinct got, you know, burned down. It's obvious you guys don't like the police, you know? So I think there was a certain understanding of the dynamic in the city that the soldiers had. And I think there was a certain understanding of the anger from people and the reasons behind it. And I think that's something you don't ever get from cops, for instance.
Well, just moving forward, you know, we talked about the Guard leaving. I'm just kind of curious if you can just explain for people just kind of the extent and the scope of the deployment. Because, I mean, from our understanding, currently there are 3,000 or yeah, more National yeah Guard troops deployed. And, you know, I looked this up last night, but according to the Defense Department on their website, there's only 2,500 U.S. troops in Iraq right now and 2,500 right in Afghanistan. So that's, you know, 5,000. But still, I mean, compared to over 3,000 troops in, you know, Minneapolis and the surrounding neighborhoods, I mean, that's just an incredible number. And, you know, as you stated in a recent video, I mean, there's nothing new about the National Guard being sent in to quell popular unrest or break strikes, you know, sent in to quell rebellions. But I'm just curious, you know, like, what is it like there right now?
Yeah, I mean, what it is like right now, like, for instance, I had a coworker, black mom, three kids, and she posted recently just, she said, you know, going to the store, she feels like she's in The Handmaid's Tale, you know, because you go you go down to just the drugstore or the store, and there's like armored carriers and armored and troops with big rifles on the street, basically in every little section of the city where there's, you know, a concentration of businesses, there's National Guard set up. And not just in Minneapolis, but also in St. Paul and in Brooklyn Center. And then you'll see convoys of the National Guard going around. I mean, it really feels like it feels surreal. And the only thing that makes it even sort of normal is the fact that this was the case last year as well. So for, you know, in the summer last year and now again in the early spring of this year, we're dealing with this major armed presence in the Twin Cities. And yeah, it's sort of shocking to everybody. And yeah, I don't know exactly how to explain it. I mean, nothing seems normal the last couple of years, right? I mean, there is no more normal. And this is just one of the sort of really stark instances of it, is to have the military set up all over your city.
You know, one of the things the police said in a recent, they did like a little presentation and press conference, and they had this kind of like pathetic display of quote weapons that they had found. Yeah. And it was like
literally, soup can, right?
Yeah, like literally a flat of soup and like some like some umbrellas, and there was like a bunch of shields, of course, which you know are defensive instruments to stop people, you know, literally stop tear gas. And but I mean, the picture that they're painting, of course, is that these are just these out of control, violent people, and that therefore they need this, you know, massive buildup. And, you know, it's all about protecting businesses and stuff. I mean, I'm just curious, you know, obviously we don't agree with that, but I mean, how does that square with what you're seeing and what you're hearing on the ground?
There's still a range of kind of consciousness and opinion about how the police should be resisted or how movement should develop. So it's not like there's a, you know, it's not like there's a consensus on it amongst the broad working class in the Twin Cities. But I think that there is an amazing, to me, it's an amazing fact that the police have not been able to reestablish their legitimacy in the Twin Cities. I think that growing up in the United States, we're so used to the police being sort of this thing that is pushed down our throats as, you know, heroes on TV and, you know, in popular official culture. Police are just revered. And so the idea that there'd be a sort of, you know, a middle-sized major city in the United States where the police have lost their legitimacy, not just in sort of one corner of the city, but widely, and that it, even after months of propaganda and even after some real, you know, and, you know, real issues of crime have emerged that the people and the population have to deal with, that the police still don't have their legitimacy back. And I think it's because of the power of the movement and the uprising, and just the facts of the role of the police has just become apparent to more and more people. And so I think that's sort of the really foundation of all the of the movement. And so then when the police do another sort of egregious crime, like with Dante Wright, there's already this sort of like basis of understanding. And so the movement that emerges, the sharp movement against it, is aimed at really punishing the system for this crime more than it is about sort of like pleading with the system to get better. Not that there aren't different illusions in the system or different hopes that there can get better, but I think more and more there's a sense that, you know, the people have to take back some power, and that can take a whole variety of avenues, you know, from very reform-minded ideas to very radical revolutionary ones. But it is striking to me, in my lifetime, I've never seen the sort of lack of legitimacy that the system has amongst a wide, you know, swath of the population.
I just kind of wanted to jump back to the question of labor. And recently, people in the Amalgamated Transit Union, bus drivers refused to transport people that had been arrested by the police. I'm just curious if there's other examples that you know of labor kind of taking a position in all this. Mm-hmm. And what do you think the possibilities are for future endeavors in that vein?
I mean, I think the big thing is that the power of the uprising has infected all of society, including the labor movement. I wish I could say that the labor movement had played some kind of like leading role or had made some sort of substantial contribution to the uprising, but that just wasn't the case. Now, that isn't to say there weren't individual union workers or even groups of union workers who participated in stuff, and a number of unions raised resolutions, and clearly the consciousness of union workers, especially, you know, workers of color and the white workers who are close with them, was shifted and moved and given confidence by the uprising. But as a whole, the labor movement, I think we have to say, has not been up for the task, you know, has just not met the need of the moment. Now, there's starting to be some change in that. And I think the action at the labor center the other night was a small example of that. But even more so has been the division that it exposed within the labor movement. So a number of unions have taken sides on it, so to speak, over whether this was a good thing or a bad thing to do. And a number of unions have, put out some really horrible shit in terms of lauding the National Guard and how dare anybody criticize the National Guard. And of course, none of these people, who claim they care about the well-being of these soldiers ever raise a complaint about the National Guard being sent around the world to Afghanistan or Iraq. But now all of a sudden they're concerned about some labor activists who are mad that the labor center was given over to the National Guard. So it's exposed some divisions that exist within, you know, the working class, and particularly maybe especially within the white working class. But to me, that's not a bad thing. You know, those divisions were there and they were unspoken and they kind of covered up some real shit. And so this episode has brought them to the fore and forced more people to think about it and talk about it and justify where they stand on the issue. And I think that's a good thing. But more has to happen. So one thing that's happened in the Twin Cities is that about 50 different community organizations, including a number of unions, including some important ones, our union, but also some unions much bigger than ours, have signed on to a call demanding the end to this Operation Safety Net. A petition or an open letter is not the most militant thing in the world, but I think taking a clear public stand against a military operation directed by, you know, a Democratic farmer labor governor, mayors, and sheriff is a positive thing, you know. And I think staking out some territory that aligns organized workers with the youth in the streets is really important. And it makes it harder to repress the movement as a whole. I think if we can get any sort of, you know, large section of the organized working class into not just verbal solidarity, but into concrete material solidarity with the young people out in the streets, that is, you know, a very favorable recipe and something that I think, we need to do. I think unions have a lot to learn from the Minneapolis uprising of the last period. Definitely as much to learn as to teach, that's for sure. So there have been some positive things, but not nearly enough. And I see it as us just sort of starting to earn our right to have a seat at the table, if you will.
Well, as we're recording this today, lots of students are taking part in walkouts. And I'm just curious if you could maybe speak to that a little bit. It's exciting to see other sections of the working class beginning to engage in self-activity.
Right. No, I think the schools are a big problem for the system on a number of fronts. One, of course, most importantly, is the youth. And the youth were the engine behind the uprising in Minneapolis. And, you know, I say thank God for the youth because their boldness and their clarity about the problems in our society has really been, you know, irreplaceable and so important. And I have a 17-year-old and a 21-year-old sons, and they were both, you know, participants in the uprising, as was their generation, really. And so, yeah, they give me a tremendous amount of hope about our future. I think that they are better human beings than the past generation, which is a good thing, right? You don't want it to go the other way. And I also think that they're already learning stuff. So my oldest son, who's 21 now, you know, when Jamar Clark was killed, you know, going on 5 years ago, there were walkouts in the high schools then. And so really, there's been a whole sort of generation of students who've grown up protesting against police murders, racism, police murders, and other issues, and using the walkout as a method. So we got to think about, what does that mean for all these kids who then go into working, you know, in their 20s, you know, some of them having families and that kind of thing, that they've already had this mass experience of walkouts. That can't help but be a good thing in terms of what that brings to the working class as a whole, in terms of its knowledge and confidence and ideas about how to fight. So that's a really good thing. And then, I mean, the secondary thing is the teachers, you know, the teachers union in St. Paul, immediately after, you know, we got the guard to leave, put out a really good statement criticizing the housing of the National Guard at the St. Paul Labor Center. And that was good, because at the same time, all these reactionary statements were coming out from different unions, like the carpenters and the operating engineers, who put out really bad statements. So I think the teachers, you know, are being pulled along by the youth, and the teachers are often, you know, saying things that are much more in tune with what's going on in the world than other unions. And I think in large part that's because of their proximity to the youth.
You know, one thing I've heard articulated by people is that coming out of last year was so intense, and now there's been another wave of protests. And I feel like some people are sort of burned out, and they're saying, like, well, you know, we voted for Biden and that didn't work, and, you know, all this stuff popped off. But I think, you know, so that I see in some people some sort of pessimism that comes with, you know, every cycle of struggle. But at the same time, like you said, I don't think I've ever, and I totally agree with you, I've never seen a time in which these institutions are so devalued and people are just kind of questioning the baseline. I mean, even kind of like classically, like, holding the line of neoliberalism, like institutions like on TV, like Saturday Night Live and John Oliver recently have basically come out and said, like, people are destroying property. Well, what do you expect? What else can they do? And I just, even kind of like that kind of baseline level neoliberal kind of box just seems to have been broken. And I'm just kind of curious, you know, for those of us that have been around for a while and look at this stuff critically, I mean, how do we make sense of that? Both kind of the pessimism of just coming up against this immense counterinsurgency operation, just the violent nature of the state, but also more and more people kind of awakening to the reality of that and just saying, like, man, this whole thing is fucked.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right about both counts. I mean, certainly struggle is exhausting. And, you know, even this week when I was getting all this, you know, hate mail and there's all this sort of, you see this sort of right wing in the unions trying to use the moment to flex back on what we were able to accomplish. You know, you get anxious, you get anxiety, and and that's just one, you know, one little instance in the struggle. So certainly it's exhausting. Certainly there's lots of disappointments. Things don't move as fast as we'd hoped. various forces of power are able to co-opt and corral a lot of our movements. All that's always been true. But I think the point I'm trying to make, and maybe you agree with, is it's getting more difficult for them to do that. And I think that's important. And, you know, it's a strong, you know, system that it's getting weaker, but it's still a very powerful, dangerous system. And it's not going to be just overturned easily, or transformed easily. It's going to take, you know, a generation or more of struggle. And, that's hard, you know, and I think I try and, you know, my attitude is like, I don't expect anything from anybody, you know, so I don't get mad at people who get tired and need a break or just decide that they're going to focus on what they can control in their own lives. I don't think it's worthwhile sort of like shaming people into struggle or something like that. Because the other thing is like, I find that a lot of people that were active in struggles in the 80s and the 90s, but maybe had to take breaks or maybe got diverted by this or that in their lives, are very much open and attuned and supportive to what's going on. Like, people are very excited and enthused by it. So I think it's important to stay open to people, even if they are, you know, momentarily cynical or tired or exhausted, and to keep lines of communication open and to keep lines of, you know, mutual aid open and friendship open, because, you know, it's a 12 round, you know, match. It's not a 3-round match. You know, we're going to be going for a while. So we need to stay connected to people. But the good news, of course, is the youth, you know, they're strong and smart and funny as hell. And, I don't know. They just give me great hope. That isn't to say there isn't a ton of stuff that could be criticized and should be criticized and could be done better, but I'm frequently just made happy and impressed by the militancy and the sharpness of young folks.
Okay, we are back again for another week. There's lots going on, as always. We have a lot of topics to cover this week. Not all good news. Happy to report, though, there's a lot going on in the streets. There's a lot of things popping off. You know, the fight against the Line 3 pipeline is continuing. You know, shout out to all the people at the Yellow French tree sit today. The second person was arrested and extracted from there. People have been fighting there on the ground for, I mean, I think well over 3 or 4 years. The current tree sit that just ended today, this is being recorded, so probably by the time you hear this, it'll be a couple more days. But the current iteration has gone over 900 days, which is just incredible. I mean, people there have been, like, working their ass off. You know, while the second person was being arrested, there was, like, a community rally in support of them. I mean, there's definitely a lot of people on the ground that live in that area, that are from that region, that definitely support what's happening. They've... you know, definitely put a lot of work into this, and, you know, this fight is not over. But there's a lot happening, you know, those things mentioned, but also beyond that, there's like an uptick in like really militant resistance to, the eviction of encampments across the United States, which is really interesting. You know, I wouldn't have like guessed that was going to kick off a couple months ago, but like in Minneapolis and like right now as we're recording, the police are gearing up to try to raid Echo Park in Los Angeles. It's going to be interesting to see what happens with that. There's just a lot of stuff going on for sure in a lot of different areas, and a lot of different things are happening. So shout out to everybody in the streets that's doing stuff. We're going to turn first of all to these mass shootings that have taken place in Atlanta, where 8 people were killed. 6 of them were Asian women. And then in Colorado, there was a gunman that opened fire on a shopping center, killed 10 people, I believe. You know, before we kind of get into this, I do want to encourage people. There's a really good podcast panel we did maybe a couple years ago. It was right after the March for Our Lives movement kicked off, but it's called In the Shadow of the Gun. It talks a lot about this stuff. But just to get us started, I wanted to read from this interview that the Socialist Rifle Association did with the Anti-Fascist Network. And you can actually listen to an interview with the Socialist Rifle Association we did on our podcast not that long ago. But they said, I think it's important to understand gun deaths in America in general and mass shootings are two separate phenomena. The majority of gun deaths in America are suicides. The suicide rate in the U.S. is largely due to poverty and economic insecurity. And you know, from last week, we talked about, you know, this exploding suicide crisis that we have in the United States. They go on to say mass shootings, however, are a separate issue. A useful way to look at them is mass shooters are that they are America's equivalent to suicide bombers or car bombers. I think this is a really right on way of looking at it. I feel like for younger folks, Zoomers and millennials, I feel like we've kind of grown up in the shadow of Columbine. So we've never really known a period, or maybe a little bit of a period, maybe when we were like super young, but you know, basically all of our youth has been kind of like colored by this specter of mass shootings. And like, if you continue onward from like, Dylan and Klebold, the people that carried out the Columbine shootings, onto people like Elliot Rodgers, you know, definitely somebody that created like, kind of a mystique about themselves. And there's of course all the white nationalist mass shooters. I mean, there's a tendency for these people to definitely be on the reactionary right in terms of the political spectrum. Like, for instance, the Parkland shooter carved swastikas onto his weapon, like wore a MAGA hat, posted a lot of racist memes. So there's definitely that element to it. But there seems to be something that's happened over the last couple of decades where it's like people that feel that they are just totally rejected and dejected from society, that are going nowhere, that they have an opportunity to kind of like redeem themselves by going on these mass killing sprees, and almost like the suicide bomber, where it's like, you know, in death they can become something that they weren't able to in life. And I think in different societies we see this playing out in different ways, but in the US, as the SRA said, and I totally agree with this, we see this again and again with this sort of cult, if you will, of the suicide bomber.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot in a statement like that. And I think on some level, I'm hesitant to talk about mass shooters in generalities, right? Because it is a complicated phenomenon. However, there are a few things which I think are really important to point out. First is suicide bombers are also a really complicated phenomenon, right? We in the U.S., I think, have an incredibly limited reductionistic understanding of that. There tends to be this assumption that people who engage in car bombings and stuff are devoted, dedicated. They're not always. If you watch the videos that they release before they go do something like this, they're often people who showed up, you know, in a place like Syria 2 weeks beforehand, right? From Australia or something like that, right? They're not hardcore dedicated participants. They're people that were motivated by life circumstances. They took on a politics to explain that. That politics led them to the situation. We see a similar thing with mass shooters too. We were talking about this before we started recording, but you know, in the 90s in Columbine, the people who shot up Columbine kind of expressed a mishmash of sort of, you know, late 90s alternative edgelord culture, right? Like one of them was really into Hitler, but they would also be into like Bad Religion. They would also be into like, you know, Nazi death metal, right? Like they were into anything that was extreme. As time has gone on, what we've started noticing is that mass shooters in the U.S. tend to, although this isn't always the case, but they have tended to have a very specific reason as to why they're doing a thing that they can articulate politically. That's a really big difference from what we saw in the 90s. And that's been an evolution that's occurred for a while in some ways. However, we have to think about the wider context of this, right? We'll talk about gun control in a second, because the problem is not firearms. The AR-15 was released in the United States as a civilian weapon in the mid-1970s. There were some bank robberies in Norco, California and L.A., which involved the use of assault weapons for the first time. And that often led to the development of SWAT teams, right? However, those kinds of weapons were not used in mass shootings at that period of time. They started getting used in mass shootings in the late 1980s. And what's really important about that, I'm sure a lot of us remember this term from when we were kids. People used to talk about going postal, right? What that meant and what that term derived from was a period of time in the mid to late 1980s when Ronald Reagan turned the Postal Service into a public-private partnership. It was no longer a government entity. And in the process, many union workers got laid off and many union workers got their pay downgraded, lost their severances, things like that. As a result, postal workers started shooting up their workplaces. And they started using assault weapons to do it. Now, that is directly a response to conditions that were born out of capitalism, directly. Now we go a little bit forward and we start asking, well, what do we find in common with mass shooters over time? And we tend to see something very similar. And again, this is expressed in a lot of different ways. Some of them are really repugnant and awful, but there's an underlying current in which the people that carry out these kinds of actions either feel very directly under threat by some outside force they can't control. So we could add the Nashville bomber into that category, right? People who have done these things for the purposes of like conspiracy theories or things like that. I would even argue that the guy who shot up the Republican congressional baseball practice fell into this category as well. Right? He's a person who felt that the political and economic situation was completely out of control and that the people on that baseball field were the ones making that happen single-handedly. And there was nothing else to do except to do that. Right. So there's a person who felt that things were out of control. The world was falling apart and they didn't have any agency, which I think is actually the really big thing. They did not feel that they had agency in that, in their lives. Right. This is a common thing that comes up with mass shooters. Dale Baran in It Came From Something Awful, which is a book about 4chan, talks about how that sense of dispossession really bred things like the rise of the far right on the internet, the rise of, you know, kind of pickup culture and misogyny on the internet, right? A lot of that was initially driven before it kind of metastasized into that form. Years before that was being articulated by the same people as a sense of loneliness or a sense of dispossession or a sense of disempowerment. Right. There are other places in the world where people have firearms in the way that we do, like Canada, Switzerland, right? Where everyone in Switzerland serves in the military. And when you get out of the military, they issue you an assault weapon to keep in your house. Every household in Switzerland has one, right? They don't have mass shootings. You know, there have been mass shootings in places like Australia, but they're really rare. Places like South Africa, but they're really rare, right? There do not tend to be mass killings in the same way in other parts of the world. When there are mass killings in other parts of the world, they do tend to be in places where there's an active, high-intensity conflict, which is not what we see here. And so we have to wonder all of a sudden, what is it about America that creates this problem? I am not a person who claims to have an answer to that because I don't, right? I don't know. That answer is incredibly complex. But what I can tell you is that firearms are not the cause of this. What I'm very concerned about, though, is just as January 6th became the foundation for Democrats to start calling for new counterterrorism powers, these mass shootings have been exploited by Democrats to start calling for gun control. And we have to be really, really, really careful when it comes to these questions of things like gun control.
According to Wikipedia, which of course is not a definitive source, but it's saying that in 2020, there was 15 mass shootings resulting in 521 deaths and over 2,500 injuries.
Yeah, yeah, that all sounds right. And you can see why people would say maybe we should, you know, not allow for assault weapons or something like that. But there's a number of problems here. First, and you know, we just went over this, that doesn't solve the problem. We have seen in other parts of the world, like say, for example, in China, this has happened, or in Japan, this has happened, or in the UK, this has happened, places where it is almost impossible to get your hands on a firearm. Attacks that involve the attempt to kill large amounts of people will still happen. They happen way less frequently there, but they still happen. They just use different weapons, right? So it's not the guns that are the problem. That's just logically true. So there's something else going on here. That's really the thing we need to focus on. The problem with gun control is sort of multifaceted, though. The first is a sort of basic foundational issue. So, you know, the right wing really loves the Second Amendment, you know, and for them, they interpret the Second Amendment as like they get to have like big, huge guns in their house and like, you know, shoot exploding targets and, you know, fire handguns off the back of their ATVs or whatever, right? Like, to them, this is about fun and recreation, freedom, blah, 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 blah. But the reality of the Second Amendment is that the Second Amendment is actually really unique globally. We are potentially the only place on Earth in which the idea that armed resistance to the government, that concept of armed resistance to the government is enshrined in constitutional practice, right? Like the Second Amendment, the idea of the Second Amendment was specifically, and I'm not arguing that this is good strategy or anything, because frontal conflict with the US state is suicidal and ridiculous. But the idea behind the Second Amendment was specifically to allow for people to be able to combat tyranny. That was the idea. That is not how the right wing portrays it now, but that was the concept. And so involved in that is a basic sort of attempt to problematize a basic reality of the state, which is the state is an entity which uses armed force to perpetuate its existence, right? To impose sovereignty and to continue to do so. At the point in which the state is also allowed to determine what weapons one has in their home or what weapons people have collectively, that is also the state making the declaration that any means of defense or revolt against the state is wrong. Now, again, frontal confrontation with the US state is ridiculous. I would argue that even basing the ideas of resistance on the ownership of firearms is ridiculous for a lot of reasons. However, at the same time, the idea behind firearms ownership in the Second Amendment is one which is based in an attempt to combat the rise of what, you know, in constitutional language is called tyranny, right? That's a really important thing. But then the other element of this, which I think is really, really, really critical on a very practical level. So we have to think about how gun control tends to happen in the United States. What the government will not do is they will not seize people's firearms. That is not a thing that is going to happen in the US. The political cost of that would be astronomical. People would die, right? Like there would be armed conflict over that attempt. It's not going to happen. What will happen though, and what does happen, is they engage in what they call grandfathering, right? So it's this idea that, say, the assault weapons ban from the 90s, which, you know, was able to sunset in the early 2000s, and that's where we start seeing a proliferation of assault weapons in the United States again. But under the assault weapons ban, you could not buy an assault weapon in the United States unless that assault weapon had been imported or made and purchased before the assault weapons ban went into effect. So if you already owned an assault weapon, you could sell it to somebody else, right? You could use it yourself. What you couldn't do was buy a new one. And all that did was just make the price of assault weapons go up. It didn't actually stop people from having assault weapons, right? But in our situation right now, there is a very deep concern about this. And the basic reality that we see in the United States right now is that, unfortunately, the people with the worst politics are also the people with the most weapons. And I don't think there's any way to really contest that. What is deeply, deeply, deeply concerning about this idea that, you know, the government could decide what means we can use to defend ourselves is that we then all of a sudden end up with an inability to defend ourselves against non-state adversaries as well, right? That we don't have the ability to defend our house. We don't have the ability to deter attacks. We don't have that ability. And again, the use of firearms should never be the primary method through which those things exist. However, it is one. And the idea that we would not be allowed to have any level of parity to be able to defend ourselves against people who very openly declare their desire to wipe us off the face of the planet and throw us out of helicopters is a bit of a problem. And so we really need to watch this. And we really need to watch this, especially because gun control is not going to be a thing which passes through Congress. That's already clear. Joe Manchin, the senator from West Virginia, who is a Democrat, already said he would not vote for gun control, which kills the ability of the Democrats to pass it through the Senate. So it's not going to happen through the Senate. The most worrying element of this is that they are talking about imposing gun control through executive order. Now, when Trump was in office, the Democrats really hated this idea of ruling by fiat, in which presidents just declare what they want and just make it happen. And every president does do this. What has changed over time, though, is that presidents have done this about in relation to more and more and more fundamental elements of our own lives. That it used to be that presidents used executive orders for very tangential things or things which involved like governmental administration, stuff like that. Now, executive orders are used for things like border policy, sending soldiers to war, imposing gun control rules, like things which are really, really significant changes to our lives. Those decisions are being made purely by the executive branch. And so what we're facing right now is we're looking at a situation which, as a result of these really tragic events, which occurred in Atlanta and occurred in Boulder, the Democrats are exploiting this and using executive power to unilaterally impose gun control on everybody else. Right. This is a thing that we should be deeply, deeply, deeply concerned with. Like, I don't think we need to be out there like at pro-gun rallies and stuff like that, although if you want to do that, that's fine. But we should definitely be paying very careful attention to this. We definitely should be, you know, as vocal as we feel safe being about our opposition to gun control as anarchists. Right. And I think this is something which really does, in a lot of ways, differentiate our politics from a lot of the other people that many of us consider to be sort of concurrent political tendencies. So unlike progressives, unlike even a lot of socialists, I would argue that it is impossible for an anarchist to be pro-gun control because gun control implies laws and specifically implies maintaining the ability of the state to have an almost total monopoly of force in relation to the imposition of laws. That is something that we should be opposing in any way that we see fit.
Well, I mean, I think it's important to point out that in a settler post-colonial society, the tendency, like as you said, has always been for the state to disarm certain communities, largely of color, specifically Black and Indigenous, from arming themselves, and instead to encourage this sort of auxiliary vigilante violence from, you know, the white settler population. And I think the fact that there's this decades and decades and decades of sort of the Turner Diaries, you know, on constant repeat, that the state is going to come and take your guns and blah, 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 and that's going to be the start of the American Civil War and so on and so forth. I mean, that's the constant fear. I mean, remember when Trump was tweeting before the election, like, literally vote for me or they're going to take your guns. I mean, it's just like, it was ridiculous that, like, you know, he would say that. It's like, you know, vote for me or the Democrats are going to steal all the air and you're going to die because you won't have any air to breathe. But I mean, like, it was basically the same thing, you know. It was just kind of this, and it's at such a point now where it's like, you know, that is the trope, and it's just been repeated and, you know, repeated so much in different ways, whether it's the Turner Diaries and it's sort of like racial composition or it's something else. I mean, Robert Williams, in his recent podcast series on fascism, talked about how a lot of the InfoWars people went on to basically rewrite the Turner Diaries and like took out some of the racist stuff. And instead of the Jews, it was the globalists. Instead of, you know, the black people working for the Jews, going around picking up all the guns, it was, you know, gun rights advocates. But it was essentially the same story, that the state was going to take the guns away from the people that had to like have the trigger leveled against tyranny. And I think, again, that really speaks to the settler colonial foundations of the country, that essentially, you know, that kind of block made up almost sort of like a quasi auxiliary military aspect of the society that had its own sort of interest. And of course, one of its interests is that it wanted to basically continue to be armed in order to subjugate those below it, in order to preserve that basic aspect of white supremacy.
Right. Well, and we can see this very clearly in the process of passing the first modern gun control laws. So like the first gun control laws in the U.S. were really passed in the early 20th century, the National Firearms Act, which banned automatic weapons. It's why you can't buy Thompson submachine guns in the United States without very specific permits and a lot of money. Right. But the first contemporary gun control laws were actually passed in California, interestingly enough, in response to the Black Panther Party.
Of course. Well, I mean, the other thing that I would go on to argue is that I think that this kind of like creation of mass anxiety, that people have to be armed, that they're going to be called on by the state, I think that's one of the key aspects that's creating this sort of culture that feeds into this sort of martyrdom of mass shooters. I'm actually going to read from an article that we published a couple years ago. It's called Lipstick on a Pig, White Anxiety, Anti-Blackness, and Mass Gun Violence. This is on It's Going Down, of course. I encourage people to read this. It says, meanwhile, we are also seeing a breaking point in mass white anxiety. Since the founding of the United States, white men of various classes have been told to prepare for civil war, to be ready to catch the escaped slave, to root out the commie from the workplace, and to defend the homeland from external and internal enemies. In fact, the well-regulated militia of the Second Amendment actually referred to the slave patrol, which gave rise to the modern police force. Subsequent gun control legislation from the late 1800s to the passing of bills aimed at curtailing the use of arms by the Black Panthers, which you talked about, all aimed at disarming black people. While these original forms and modes of governance have evolved and changed, they are still fundamentally functioning the same way within our society, albeit in a much expanded form. But this is not just the fear that this mass anxiety produces, or the constant desire to find these enemies which are promoted as supposedly omnipresent, but moreover, it is the anxiety of not being called on by the state to engage in its defense. This is why people join militias and tell themselves that defending a billionaire is fighting globalism. This is why the right loves InfoWars conspiracy theories that read like a WWF script, and why people bought into the manufactured idea of the Antifa civil war. This is why the snake oil from CPAC about Islam or Antifa all sounds like repackaged anti-Semitic and anti-communist conspiracy theories, because they are. It's not just being that those on the right like being lied to, it's that they've heard the song before. And the key point here is that people aren't being called on by the state. So we're like, we're in this situation where it's like, we're constantly militarizing, the police are constantly militarizing, we're being pumped full of fear, but also like the state is at a point where, you know, because of poverty, it has enough people to go out and fight like all the wars that it has right now. Right. It doesn't need these people basically to go off into the frontier and like put down, you know, native insurgencies. Like, definitely Trump called on people to like go out and fight Black Lives Matter. And that definitely happened. I mean, obviously people were murdered. You know, militias came out. There's lots of examples of that. So I don't want to downplay that. But at the same time, we don't see this on like this massive, like, level where the state, you know, mechanizations go into place and people are like subsumed by the state to engage in like full out war. I mean, like, this is the stuff that the right fantasizes about, and it's not happening. Like, and this is also ties into this whole thing where like the right wants Trump to cross the Rubicon to like, you know, enter the state of exception where the state's just going to massacre everybody. I mean, that's the desire. I mean, we've talked about again and again on this podcast, like how disgusting it is and like how scary it is. But I mean, that's that desire. So when that doesn't happen, you know, there's all these people that have this anxiety, and then, you know, they're just kind of left with this, like, nothingness. And I think it just explodes, as we've seen time and time again in these mass shootings. And maybe not even in a way that people are aware of, but it, it definitely adds to this feeling of tension across the country. And then when you add into that all of the factors which are causing, like, this massive eruption of suicides in this country, and also overdoses. I mean, that just fits in as well, because people are feeling that they are, you know, they didn't live up to the standards of what it means to be, quote, a man. Like, they weren't able to, to go to college and get that job. Like, they failed at basically all the things that society told them that you actually need to check these boxes on. And instead of basically being able to look at society and say, like, the odds are stacked against us because of all these structural problems that are based around race and class, which are created by a capitalist civilization. Instead, they basically say, like, oh no, the problem of society itself, where's the gun? Where do I start shooting? That's the only way to basically abolish my own condition.
Yeah, well, and in an entirely atomized social circumstance, which is created by capital, right? I mean, like, we have to remember, capitalism functions sort of existentially through the construction of us as isolated economic units, isolated individuals, right? There is no social cohesion. There's just markets. And those markets are out of our control. And so we wonder why people feel like they have no control over their lives, right? That atomization really, when it's combined with concepts of masculinity, for example, and this idea of sort of constantly being under attack, right, which is sort of the flip side of this citizen soldier mentality. The idea that people are going to go be mass shooters is not that far off from that sort of toxic mixture. I think what's one of the things that's really relevant about that, outside of the fact that really there are a lot of core issues that need to be dealt with if we're ever going to talk about how to prevent mass shootings. But another element of this is, you know, there's been a tendency amongst some people on the quote left to embrace gun culture in what I would argue is an unhealthy way, right? It is pretty important to know how to use tools, right? And a firearm is a tool, just like a shovel, right? It's really important to know how to use tools and to use tools that you feel you need to use. What we can't do is fetishize them. We can't turn them into an aesthetic. We can't turn them into a politics. And we cannot embrace this idea that because one owns firearms, that they are a privileged defender of, quote, the people, right? Which is how Maoists have started to take it. That all of a sudden they can go down to, like, you know, whatever, Cabela's, and buy a rifle, and all of a sudden they're like a Maoist revolutionary, right? It's ridiculous. And someone is going to get hurt, right? And a lot of that has to do with the fact that people are mirroring right-wing gun culture with different politics, but the same social dynamics. And we need to get away from that, right? We need to treat these things as they are. Inert hunks of metal that do things. They're tools, right? And they're tools that can protect us. And they're tools that can also get you in a lot of trouble. And they're tools that can really harm people. And we have to think about it in that way. We cannot fall into essentially becoming the flip side of the citizen soldier mentality.
Yeah. Well, people love, right? People love extremes in a lot of examples. You know, I remember, you know, there's a great quote from David Gilbert where he was talking about sexuality and he said, you know, our society, we're told basically you can have one of two positions. You can either, like, align yourself with, like, Hustler magazine and just be, like, you know, some sort of, like, weird misogynist whatever, or you can be, like, some sort of, like, Puritan where, like, sex is dirty. And, like, you know, somewhere in between there's got to be, like, this, like, healthy functioning thing where it's, like, yes, sexuality is good, sexuality is all these things, but also we've got, like, come at it from, like, you know, an actual intelligent stance that, like, doesn't harm people and, like, you know, actually develops freedom and relationships and community and expression, so on and so forth. I mean, I think the same thing with, you know, firearms. Like you said, they're tools, but they should obviously be treated with respect. And I also think, like, I totally agree with you. I think that it's actually a mistake to, like, fetishize these things.
Yeah, well, and, you know, there's a reason why. Like, the federal government really doesn't like when anarchists have guns. They've been very, very, very clear about that for about 100 years. You know, like, that's pretty unequivocal, right? There's no way to in any way confuse their stance on that. But, yeah, I mean, a lot of that culture to me feels like posturing, right? And it feels like a lot of people putting forward an image of strength, which sort of covers up a lack of that, right? That there's this sense in which, you know, power derives from the barrel of a gun, right, Mao? And people are embracing that, and that's a problem because it doesn't. Power derives from action, and that sometimes involves different tools. But it does not derive from inert hunks of metal, right? That building power is hard, and it involves a lot of hard work. And we can't just shortcut that through weapons, right? We can't just be strong because we have big, huge, tactical-looking guns and stuff. Like, we have to get away from that. We have to really, really get away from that. And we need to be, I mean, just like we're talking about with mass shootings, we need to be aware of the social context in which these things exist. Just as firearms are not the cause of mass shootings, but they are the medium through which they occur, many other damaging things can occur through that medium. And all of those damaging things will be the result of the collision of social circumstances with that medium. We cannot just shortcut our way around that by owning firearms, which is what a lot of people have attempted to do in the last series of years. It's not that easy. There's a lot of problems in America, and a lot of those problems revolve around questions of things like race and class. And a lot of those problems involve questions of the ability of certain communities to defend themselves, right? Robert Williams, the former NAACP president from North Carolina, who fled to China and wrote many books about Black guerrilla warfare, very specifically made this argument in which he said, look, we can't just think of any tool as the tool for our freedom. None of that, those don't exist. If they existed, we would have had freedom a long time ago. But the reality is that every tool exists in the context that we live in. And the problems that will result from the usages of those tools are the result of the context in which they're used. And so whenever we use a tool, whatever tool it is, we have to be aware of the context of its use and the possible negative outcomes of that. That goes quadruple for firearms, which are dangerous and require reverence when handling them, right? And are scary and are tools of liberation at times and tools of repression at other times, right? We have to be incredibly aware of those things. But at the same time, we have to also not start jumping on the reactionary bandwagon of being cool with the state taking things away, especially tools that are used to potentially defend ourselves from it. This is a really important point. And it's one of these things that liberals kind of fail at understanding, right? That for liberals, they don't mind gun control for a very basic reason. They're not trying to fight the state. They don't care about that. They don't need to defend themselves often. Liberals just call the police, right? We don't do that. We are fighting the state. We are fighting the right wing. We don't call the police, right? We have a very different context in which we have to be concerned about these things. And so when we're talking about this stuff, questions like gun control that result from tragedies like this are really complicated questions. But they're also really simple ones on a very basic level, right? That this is a question of law. And most importantly, it's a question of the ability of the state to impose law unchallenged. But it is also a complicated question of class and race in America and the role of firearms in maintaining that, as well as fighting against that, right? We need to be aware of all of these things as we're sort of engaging with questions like this, because they are both very simple and very hard at the same time. The thing that I find most disgusting about this debate right now, though, is the way that the Democratic Party is exploiting these tragedies to push a policy agenda. It's absolutely sick.
We're going to talk now about the controversy surrounding Alexander Reed Ross. You know, full disclosure, Reed Ross wrote a series of columns for It's Going Down in 2015. That's quite good. It's I think it's excellent. It's called Trumpism. It's kind of like the history of Trump and sort of like where he comes from, what he comes out of, and sort of the ideas behind him, and makes the argument that he is creating a sort of American fascism. I think it's great. We still have it in zine version on the site. I encourage people to read it. Ross has also written a couple of other original pieces for IGD about anti-fascism. So basically what happened is in the last couple of weeks, people from Gray Zone, which is sort of like, I believe you refer to it as InfoWars for tankies, which is great. InfoWars for tankies. People on Gray Zone have pointed out that Reed Ross has worked on a study for this site called Network Contagion, which includes basically like, you know, people that are kind of high up in former like government or policing positions or from the corporate world. He collaborated on some study with them. You might remember Network Contagion. We talked about them. They issued a report called like Network Anarchy, and they referred to autonomous movements as anarcho-socialists. And basically, their whole takeaway was that there are children online that are sharing memes, and they're very edgy, and some of them even have nasty words aimed at police officers. And some of these groups, like Redneck Revolt, which doesn't exist anymore, are forming militias, which is not true. And websites like It's Going Down, because we retweet things, we are the masterminds behind riots. And also because of all these things and much more, that anarchists are going to engage in some sort of 9/11 event. They refer to it as a drastic terrorist attack that takes human life or something like that, which of course is like, you know, sort of like memes, unknown, 9/11. I don't know how we get there. Anyway, so this is basically who he's writing for. It's got a lot of like ex, you know, security state people in it. It's like one of those big think tanks that gets a lot of corporate and state funding. Anyway, so Ross's position is that, you know, he's an anti-fascist researcher. He'll write for basically whoever, and as long as basically what he's writing about furthers the cause of fighting against the far right and fascism, you know, we don't live in a perfect world, therefore he is going to write for whoever that he can get his stuff out, and hopefully in the long run it'll, you know, hopefully push back against the really bad folks. I'm just going to say I'm disappointed. I think Gray Zone is crap. I think that Ross working for these people that clearly are not friends of social movements from below is disappointing. I think, you know, there's lots of other places you can go to work. I think there is just so much stuff that's out there right now about the far right. I mean, there's a flood of information. I think there are, to justify going to basically work for people who literally are creating research, which is being used to justify labeling anarchists and anti-fascists as terrorists, which that anarcho-socialist report did, is just bad. You know, yeah. I think people shouldn't do it. You know, I think it's pretty basic.
Yeah. I think it is too. It's important in this discussion, and you know, we were talking about this before we start recording, but this discussion has probably taken up way more time in my life in the last week than I would have wanted it to. But there's a reason for that. And I want to dive into that, like, just very briefly before we move on to something else. The article that came out in Gray Zone was written by Max Blumenthal. So, you know, as was referred to earlier, I've referred to Gray Zone as InfoWars for tankies because it is. We had a whole episode in which we talked about left-wing conspiracy theories. The vast majority of that were references to either the PSL or Gray Zone.
And I got to say, you know, just to thicken the pot here, Alexander Reed Ross did write a fantastic article. I believe it was him, or he has written on Gray Zone attacking them. So yes, I mean,
very specific.
So they have basically, you know, they have mud on their face here. You know, they have been attacked by Reed Ross, and I know Reed Ross has a history of basically saying like, oh, like John Zerzan had a book published by, you know, Feral House, who also like published like this other book, Lords of Chaos, which is by a white nationalist. Yeah. Therefore, I mean, John Zerzan been on our show. I mean, does that mean Alexander Reed Ross is a fascist? No. But yeah. I mean, he's kind of like had a history of kind of like, you know,
reductionistic argumentation through inference. That's the way I would put it.
It's always sunny in Philadelphia. Conspiracytheories.jpg. I mean, like, yeah totally. Definitely that kind of energy.
I mean, what is incredibly ironic is Max Blumenthal does exactly the same thing constantly. He's just like, here's this very thin tangential connection, therefore really extreme inferred conclusion, right? And he did this in this article. So the article's crap. It's Max Blumenthal, so it's mostly hyperbole. It's mostly just random rhetoric with no real argumentation or points of data or anything. It's just like leftist ranting on the internet or something, pretending to be journalism. But essentially the claim that Max Blumenthal makes in the article, and this is both in the headline and inferred very strongly, although not said directly in the body of the article, is that Alexander Reed Ross is working with the state. That is not true. What is happening is that he's working for the Network Contagion Institute, which is based out of Rutgers University and is funded by a number of other universities and does involve people who used to work for the FBI and the CIA and the Department of Homeland Security and the NYPD and blah, 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 blah. That's all very true. And that is a problem, right? But it's not a problem for the reasons that Max Blumenthal lays out, right? It's not as simple and reductionistic and silly as that. It's actually a lot more complicated. And it really revolves around problems of academia and writing. So one of the claims that Alexander Reed Ross has made sort of in response to this is like, there's no perfect place to work. And that's true. There isn't, right? Everything in capitalism is tainted. However, there's a very distinct difference between, you know, working a checkout register at a Starbucks and working at an institute like this. When you work a checkout register at a Starbucks, you're making Starbucks money, but you're not directly working with an institution which has connections which are with institutions that are targeting you, right? Which is very different. Working at the SPLC is very different than working for this institution. Working at the ADL is very different than working for this institution, even though the SPLC and the ADL work directly with the state at times. The reason it's different is the role that academia plays, right? And full transparency, I am a former academic. And part of the reason I left academia is exactly what I'm about to talk about. So academia is a place of ethical ambiguity, okay? You are often getting funded by the state, at least your department is, or you're being funded by some corporate interest, or you're being funded by a foundation that was started by someone that was imbued with like money from the corporate world or whatever, right? Most of the work that you do in academia doesn't get read by anybody. Nobody cares, right? Because nobody really cares about academics. And so the idea that you're going to stop fascism from inside the academy is ridiculous. You're just not. It's not going to happen. No one cares. The only people that do care, though, and this is where it becomes a problem, are people that are connected to the people that are responsible for the work. So academic work diffuses along lines of connection, right? You give a talk at a conference, maybe a paper gets released online, but the people that really pick that stuff up and read it are people that are already studying that sort of thing or have some sort of material reason to be interested. You're not having random people on the street pick up reports by this institute and read it. Instead, what we saw from that networked anarchy report, like, which was, again, used to be an academic and I've read a lot of really dumb stuff written by academics, but that might have been hands down one of the worst pieces of political analysis I've ever read in my entire life. And that's not me just saying that because they went after us. That's me saying that just objectively. It was terrible. But that paper did have impact, because the impact of academic work has nothing to do with the validity of the work. It has everything to do with the lines of diffusion through which that work gets out into the world. And so in this case, the people that wrote that networked anarchy report were people that used to work at the NYPD and the FBI, so on, so on, so on. And they diffused that out into circles in the intelligence community. And the report popped up, getting referenced in the New York Times in an article about the report, because the report had been referenced by a Republican politician who was using it as a way to justify declaring anti-fascists as terrorists. That's how academic work gets used. And it points out a bigger problem, which is when you engage in an institution like this, you do not have control over what the effect of your work is. So, like, I fully believe that his intent is that none of this work will get used against us. I do. I really do believe that. Right. I've met Alexander Reed Ross. I don't have any reason to believe that he's not being totally genuine when he says that. Right. However, I would also argue that you can't guarantee that. There's no way to guarantee that. And so if we are going to be working on things that we are putting out into the world, and this is not just academic writing, this is any writing, we have to be aware that those things might be picked up and used in ways that are contrary to what their intent was, and that we don't have control over that necessarily. What we do have control over is what we put in that text. We have control over what we say. We have control over how we say it, how much information we give, what our strategic goals are. We have control over all of that, right? When you go to work for an institution like this, you lose your autonomy over those decisions. You have editors editing your work. You have lines of diffusion already set out for you. There's a style and a topic. All of that's defined for you. And so why does an institute like that bring someone like this on? And I think that this is really the point in which I'm very disappointed in this decision. Institutes like this bring people like that on for two reasons, right? There are many extremist researchers in America. There's many experts on fascism in America. Why hire Alexander Reed Ross, a person who is attached to numerous known anarchists in the United States, who has edited radical publications before, who clearly is not a, quote, objective researcher in any sort of way? Why hire a person like that? And the reasons are twofold and obvious, I think. The first is legitimacy. By working at a place like that, he is allowing them to claim legitimacy. They're not just some fringe national security think tank that's trying to target the left. They've got one of them working for them. How could they do that? It's an act of legitimization. And that's a huge problem. We should be doing nothing to legitimize institutions like this. But the second thing, and I think probably what's a little bit more of a problematic possibility here, is they bring people like this into academic institutions because they are experts. And because academics, a lot of times, especially in something like counterterrorism research like this, they're not necessarily experts in the things that they're writing about. They might be experts in something else, and they're using that information to inform what they're writing about. But in things like counterterrorism, oftentimes, at least when an organization like this is just getting off the ground, they're doing research about these things for the first time. That's how these people could come up with a term like anarcho-socialism, which is not a thing. And not written anywhere as a thing. But the only way you could come to that conclusion is by not really having much of an understanding of what happens in that space, right? You bring people from that space into your institute to specifically ask them for clarifying information. There's no other reason to have a person like that work there. They want the information he has. Not even for malicious purposes. I don't even believe that most of the people that work there view their work as something that targets us. They view their work as academic research, which is, quote, neutral. But it never is. And so what's happened here is that someone who is widely respected by many of us has entered into a situation which compromises his ability to be a part of what we do. That by being in a position in which one is doing work in a circle of diffusion, which is directly tied to the national security apparatus, as a person with a role whose job it is to clarify these things for people writing those reports, that is a situation in which we might need to start thinking about some distance. I'm not saying people should ostracize him. I am saying that I'm deeply disappointed, and I think that this decision was very naive. I also think that it means that we have to be careful, not just about this, but we have to be very aware, as many of us are getting older and getting professional jobs, not just in academia, but also in tech, things like this, what our work is doing, right? There is no perfect employment, but that doesn't mean that all employment is equivalent. And so if you're working at Palantir, you should probably quit, right? If you're working at a small software startup that's a worker-owned co-op with your friends, that's a little bit different. But we have to be aware of these things, not because work will ever lead us to a better world, but because we can limit the damage we do in the context of employment if we're aware of these kind of dynamics.
So speaking of the far right, you know, the wheels continue to turn against the Proud Boys. It's been interesting. So a couple things have come out in the last couple days. You know, Joe Biggs and the rest of the leadership are facing conspiracy charges. Also, different groups, like, so the Oath Keepers are now, they're saying that they were involved in plotting with different chapters of the Three Percenters and the Proud Boys in different online forums. So there's been a couple things that have come out of that. One, there's talk of charging these people with sedition, which we'll talk about in length. Some people, like, for instance, Cassandra Fairbanks at the Gateway Pundit, which has basically taken on a role of calling for people to donate money to a lot of these people, really going hard for the Proud Boys and other groups. She has said that Joe Biggs, for a while now, has been giving information to the FBI about, quote, Antifa, whatever that means. You know, they don't like me. You know, like, oh,
I tripped. It was Antifa.
Right. Yeah.
I ran into my door. It was Antifa.
Can't stop posting memes about doing cocaine and other drugs. It must have been Antifa.
Totally Antifa. They hacked my accounts. It was right. Antifa. Right.
So, yeah, I keep saying I'm going to kill people on social media, and you keep visiting me about it because I'm talking about murdering people. It must be Antifa. Oh, that's who I say I'm killing. So that's happening. And then also, there's obviously some sort of confidential informant or CI within the Proud Boys, because, this shows up in the records and, you know, so somebody's snitching. Mm-hmm. So plot just continues to thicken. There was recently, in case you missed it, you can watch it on YouTube, but somebody within, I don't know if it was the Department of Justice, I believe, did an interview on 60 Minutes, and they were asked, like, will you charge these people with sedition and a bunch of other questions. But why don't you take it over and just talk about, you know, what's been coming out in the past week or so?
Yeah, so there were more conspiracy charges filed this week, which is really where this whole discussion kind of kickstarted. And those conspiracy charges were filed.
Why is that important, by the way? Does that just
mean
more time?
Yeah, I'll get to
that
in a second. Proud Boys and Oath Keepers, very specifically. Now, the conspiracy defendants are being charged specifically with having pre-planned their actions for that day. So federal prosecutors are going after groups of people that looked really organized, that might have had uniforms, that had clear command structures, right? The Proud Boys, like, gave, like, Baofeng two-way radios to certain people. And, you know, like, there's very clearly a hierarchical structure involved. Now, we have to keep in mind that conspiracy only involves conceiving of an illegal action and then taking one material step towards that action, which clearly happened here. Every single person who brought a weapon that day essentially committed conspiracy. Now, they're not charging everyone that way. They're only charging certain people that way. But that might not be ultimately what they end up getting charged with. Because what's happening in this process, and we're seeing this with a bunch of defendants, is that people are rolling on each other. And it makes sense why, from their perspective, right? Here's a bunch of people, many of which are older than most anarchists are, right? A lot of the defendants are 40 years old and up. They've got lives. They've got families. they've got often some sort of like life crisis going on. Like a lot of the people that have been arrested and charged are people that are like deeply in debt or on the verge of losing a company or blah, 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 blah. They've got stuff going on in their lives. They don't want to go to federal prison for 20 years. They decided to try and carry out a coup with no masks on in one of the most heavily surveilled places on Earth. And then they're shocked that they're facing like 20 years in prison because that's what happens. By the way, anyone out there that's ever dealing with anyone in their local area that's arguing against security culture, just point them to this. This is what happens when you have no security culture, is this. What we're seeing the right wing go through right now.
You know, it's interesting, right? in that 60 Minutes piece, they basically break down that there's three groups of people. There's the ones like the QAnon shaman who basically made a name for themselves. And he like went down the list. He's like, we were going after that guy and the Camp Auschwitz guy and the put my feet up on Pelosi's desk guy. And like everybody that's like the guy.
The dude who carried the podium.
Yeah, like that guy. They're going after them. And then they're going after the randos that they can just find because like, you know, Billy Bob from Timbuktu, we found him because he posted a snapshot. I think a lot of those people probably have their charges dropped. Like if they can't actually get them with having destroyed anything or smeared poop over anything or anything weird like that, those people will probably be dropped. Like the quote unquote average Trump supporter, they will probably get a slap on the wrist or maybe a fine or something. And then the third group is like the people in the organizations that they can try to argue were either carrying out some sort of organized plan. But I think definitely the first and the last group, they're going to like hit hard, probably the last group most specifically. And we'll probably see some sort of like, you know, construction of an argument like these are the outside agitators and, you know, the Trump people were tricked into following them or something like that.
Maybe. I mean, this is proceeding along the lines of the way that the federal government deals with drug cartels or terrorist networks, right? Like they're using the same techniques here. And often that involves rounding up a lot of people, charging them with all manner of things, and then watching them roll on each other and seeing what information you get, right? So that's obviously been a thing that's happening. The way we know that that has escaped just the randos and has now entered into those upper echelons is that the most recent indictments refer to two internal Proud Boys channels, which were only available to leadership. What's funny is that, of course, the feds got access to those Telegram channels because they flipped somebody. Or they had an informant in there the whole time. We're not quite sure which. But they definitely got access to all of those logs. What's hilarious about that is they started the second leadership group after the first. They were worried that the first one was infiltrated by the FBI. And then whoever the informant was just followed them to the new group. Right. So they were all up in the Proud Boys stuff. They were also all up in the Oath Keepers stuff. And so like there's all these articles today that have been coming out about how recent indictments against some Oath Keepers have pointed out that there was a quote alliance between the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys for January 6th to storm the Capitol. And they have full discussion logs about that. Right. So needless to say, these people are screwed. Right. And what's happening is that, you know, conspiracy charges don't send the message that the prosecutors want to send. They tried conspiracy charges against us during J20 and it failed because it's really hard to prove that people pre-planned autonomous actions. It's a lot easier to prove that in the case of the right wing because they have like organizations with hierarchies and command structures and stuff. Anyone that knows any tankies, by the way, might want to warn them about that, that if you have an organization with a command structure, it's probably a really bad idea in the 21st century for a lot of reasons.
Well, there's also a huge difference between like two bank windows getting broken on a march and
storming the Capitol.
The president of the United States, like, hey, go in that building and make sure that the person that the majority of people voted for doesn't become president. I stay president.
Totally. So freedom. What they're doing though is they're starting to migrate this around to talking about sedition charges. Now, it's really to understand what that means and why that could be a huge problem for us. We have to understand what sedition means. So sedition laws go back way into American history, into the 18th century. And in the late 18th century, there was an attempt to create sedition laws. And those laws essentially said that sedition involves any action or speech that one undertakes with the intent of overthrowing the U.S. government, period. That could be like anything. There have been people that have argued in the past that just being an anarchist is an act of sedition just all the time, right? Because like being an anarchist like involves the elimination of the state just inherently. So for an anarchist, we're doing things, we're committing sedition, right? Like under that really broad interpretation. Now, because that interpretation is so broad, sedition laws have tended to be used in like very specific circumstances. So the Communist Party in the 50s had a series of people who were actually part of an armed cell within the Communist Party charged with sedition. People who were involved in the Black Liberation Army got charged with sedition, some of them. People in the United Freedom Front got sedition charges. That sedition charges have been used in a number of cases. Most recently, they were used against a group called the Hutteri Militia, which was a right-wing group from Ohio and Michigan that was based on some really fringy, like, end of the world theory, and they were going to like kill a cop and then bomb the funeral, like something like that. They got charged with sedition. They beat those charges, by the way. Even though they had already planned the attack and been preparing for it, they beat the sedition charges, right? That's how narrow sedition is actually applied in the United States, because the other flip side of that is it could literally apply to any non-reformist political action. So any action that you're taking, which isn't asking a politician to do a thing for you, technically could be sedition, right? And so what's really dangerous about this is that the portrayal of what happened on January 6th in the liberal media and what actually happened on January 6th are different. The portrayal of what happened on January 6th in the conservative media and what happened on January 6th are different. That this has become one of those events in which historical revisionism happens in real time. And, you know, I mean, like we've joked around and called it Nazi 9/11 and all this other kind of stuff. But in reality, we have to think about what it was, right? Just from like a purely non-emotional objective perspective, it was a large group of people broke some stuff at a government building and delayed a government proceeding for 3 hours. And in that period of time, people died, most of which died from natural causes, right? If that were to be the basis for a sedition charge, any direct action could potentially be considered sedition, right? By anybody. We all know, and the history of sedition laws in the United States have been that they have primarily been used against the quote unquote left almost entirely, at least in the modern era. So from the 20th century, beginning of the 20th century on, they've been used almost entirely against the left, not completely, but almost entirely. So therefore, if they're reinterpreting sedition laws to all of a sudden cover a bunch of LARPers in military gear, the Oath Keepers, and a bunch of LARPers in, you know, Fred Perry shirts, the Proud Boys, making agreements on the internet to be LARPers together at a thing, and then that thing goes a little bit more extreme than they thought it was going to go, to consider that an act of sedition is very dangerous. Because what that essentially means is, I mean, let's just think back to the end of May and early June. Most of the organizers of those first actions in most cities were not intending those actions to turn into full-blown insurgencies. They did, but that wasn't necessarily the intent of the organizers. If the government is allowed to apply sedition laws this broadly, in theory, they could charge any of those organizers with sedition, because that was an action which was an attempt to, you know, overthrow or negatively impact the functionality of a government entity, namely the police. And if we start to enter into that space, things get very dangerous potentially. So you have to remember, I mean, I think, you know, since Biden has been inaugurated, and I think that this was inevitable, and we've talked about this on the show, but there has been a complacency that has kind of taken over. I've seen this with my friends too, and people I work with. You know, everyone's resting, and that's not bad. That's not a bad thing. Everyone should be kind of resting as much as they can now, because last year was chaos, right? We all should be pretty tired and burned out at this point, at least I would hope so. But We have to be aware of the fact that throughout the Biden administration so far, the things that have been talked about most outside of border policy have and the filibuster and the coronavirus bailout have been sedition and conspiracy charges, gun control, and new counterterrorism powers. All of those things have tended to be used against communities of color and against the left far more than everybody else. That the Biden administration and we talked about this, you know, in December and January, the Biden administration has all of the incentive to do everything they can to crush whatever parts of the quote left still doesn't want anything to do with the state. Right? That they came into office, they ran their campaign based on the idea that they were going to crush extremism, regardless of the politics of the extremist.
Yeah, well, that's how it's morphed into. Now, the talking points are around, quote, violent extremism.
Yes.
So it's basically whatever can be defined as extremism that is somehow violent, which, I mean, again, could be, I don't know, people blocking a railway, you know, a railroad, like carrying fracking material could be considered, you know, violent extremism.
Right. Yeah. Well, and, you know, I mean, this is an Edward Snowden point, but, you know, the biggest problem with state repression is that we lose the ability to control which actions we consider to be acceptable. And all of that gets centered on the state. It gets displaced from us and it gets given to an institution which has a goal of repressing resistant activity. Right.
Right. And again, this does nothing to actually address the fact that the fascist right almost carried out literally based off of the Brooks Brothers riot, you know, something that could conceivably work in the future. Again, you know, a couple years from now, a lot of people are saying, are they going to try to do this again, you know, in a different context? I think it's very well likely. We as everyday working people are not in danger that a bunch of people are going to go into a government building and smear poop on the walls. That's not going to affect us in our day-to-day lives. What is going to affect us is if a fascist far-right force, they're scared because that there's transgender bathrooms, you know, being built in the local library and black people are asking not to be killed. They're so unhappy by that. They want to install a fascist government to preserve, you know, these quote unquote traditional structural hierarchies. I mean, that's going to really impact our lives for real.
Sure. But I think the thing that's happening in this administration so far, and the thing that I think complacency is contributing to, is that they're building a state apparatus of repression, or they're expanding one, I would say. We have to keep in mind that under Democrats, this tends to happen. This happened under Obama, right? I mean, NSA surveillance programs really took off under Obama. Drone strike programs really took off under Obama. They killed an American citizen in a drone strike during the Obama administration, extrajudicially, on the order of the president. They murdered an American citizen in Yemen. Right? Like, Anwar al-Awlaki is not a great person or wasn't a great person, but still. The fact of the matter is that they, on the president's order, murdered an American citizen without a trial. Right? Like, that's a really huge jump over the line of due process. You know, under the Clinton administration, that is when we started seeing the introduction of contemporary counterterrorism laws. Right? So, I mean, outside of the Patriot Act, counterterrorism laws, gun control, and things like the application of things like sedition laws and conspiracy, also the expansion of surveillance apparatuses, tend to happen most under Democrats, right? And so we have this problem now where a lot of people are complacent, that they're tired, that, you know, the Biden administration is kind of boring, because it is. And to be perfectly honest, that's kind of refreshing, on the level of not needing to worry that the president's going to say five things a day that make me fear for my life. This is more relaxing than that. However, that complacency has allowed a lot of people to not think about the aggregate effect of what's happening right now. So if we take these things in aggregate, again, we have expanding the attempt to expand government counterterrorism powers, which involves surveillance. We have the introduction of language around extremism and sedition, which allows the government itself to define who is an extremist and what sedition is. And then we have gun control tacked on top of that, which prevents us from even defending ourselves against forces from the right wing, for example. Right? That is a very dangerous circumstance that we are entering into. And people, a lot of liberals might trust Joe Biden with those powers. I don't. But a lot of liberals might. But would you have trusted Donald Trump with those same powers? Right? Would you have trusted George W. Bush with those same powers? Because when we passed the Patriot Act, not right away, but a year or two afterwards, after the sort of shock of September 11th wore off, a lot of liberals were pretty furious about it. And yet, what is Biden proposing? But an expansion of those same powers. Right? We cannot allow the fact that he is not Donald Trump to cloud the reality of what's happening here. You know, we can't allow the fact that he's sort of a like boring old man to prevent us from asking the question of what happens to these expanded governmental powers when someone else takes office. Right? Because one of the things Edward Snowden said is whether or not you agree with surveillance powers, what you can't guarantee, if you do agree with surveillance powers, what you cannot guarantee is that those same powers will be used in a responsible way 10 years from now, or 20 years from now, or 30 years from now. So what you're essentially arguing for when you argue for surveillance powers is you are arguing for the building of an apparatus of repression and then the blind hope that it doesn't get used maliciously. That is the situation that we are now entering into. That liberals, Democrats, progressives are starting to assemble the building blocks of, and I'm not even saying that this is intentional. I'm just saying this is incidental. They are assembling the building blocks of what could become an expanded apparatus of what will become an expanded apparatus of repression. What is an expanded apparatus of repression, but what might be turned around and used against us later. We would not have had a federal intervention in Portland in the way that it happened without the existence of the Department of Homeland Security. For example, the DHS was not created to do that, but they were used that way 20 years after their creation. And so even if the original framers of the Department of Homeland Security did not view them as a force of domestic police repression, they were used that way still anyways. That is a clear demonstration of the basic reality that any of these things that people put into place today could be used for different purposes tomorrow. And that if people are going to start supporting things like sedition charges and conspiracy charges and expanded counterterrorism powers and gun control, then we have to be very, 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 very aware that when Republicans come back into office, for those liberals out there that are you know, specifically focused on that, when Republicans come into office, they have those powers too. Keep in mind, Ronald Reagan was the governor in California when they passed gun control, right? Ronald Reagan, who is a person who was endorsed by the NRA, both as a governor and president, was the person who endorsed gun control. And the reason that he did that was, again, the Black Panther Party, right? Gun control was a force of repression during that period of time. Sedition charges, conspiracy charges were used as forces of repression against the Communist Party, against SDS, against the Yippies, right? Against, you know, the urban guerrilla groups in the 70s. You know, these sorts of things will be used against us. These sorts of things will become tools in the toolbox of federal repression. You know, we were able to, through solidarity as a community, fight off what at the time was the largest mass political prosecution in American history from J20. What is happening from January 6th is now the largest mass political prosecution in American history. The difference is the right wing does not have the same ability, does not have the same solidarity, does not have the same level of organization to fight off conspiracy and sedition charges. And so what that means is that if prosecutors decide to go that route, they are very much more likely to be successful now than they were in 2016 and 17. And what that means is that they can use that to set legal precedent today that we were able to prevent them from setting 2 and 3 and 4 years ago, just as an anarchist community. The right wing doesn't have that ability. And so we should all maybe temper our complacency a bit. Maybe we should be focused and paying attention to what's going on right now. Because the Biden administration doesn't make a lot of noise. They're very, very, very quiet about what they're doing. And there's an element of returning things to normal, quote unquote, and so on. That's involved in that. But that doesn't mean that they're not doing things. And that doesn't mean that they're not doing things that could be damaging. But I would argue any action of a president is a damaging action. However, these ones very specifically will become the tools that are used against us tomorrow. And that's the thing that we need to be paying attention to. It's not about what Joe Biden says on Twitter. I think we all got very used to, strangely, Donald Trump being incredibly transparent about how he feels about things, very loudly, to the point where it dominated all of our lives. We don't have that luxury anymore. But I think there's still this tendency to assume that politics happens in the open. We have forgotten the 8 years of the Obama administration and the 8 years of a Bush administration and the 8 years of a Clinton administration. We forgot those times where most of us had almost no idea of what was happening in Washington, where politicians were generally pretty quiet, where they only made measured public statements. That's the era that we've returned back to. That's actually the period of time that personally I'm far more concerned with in some ways, right? Not in the like overt rise of authoritarianism way, but in the sort of much more disturbing covert rise of authoritarianism way, where we are watching the building of the apparatus that allows for something like authoritarianism to take hold, right? On a logistical level, like on a governmental level.
I think it's funny because in some ways this almost ties back to the Reed Ross discussion in that the people that are carrying this repression out are not fascists. They're neoliberals.
Right.
And I don't know. I find it interesting, you know, if we go along with the idea that, you know, we should work with anybody that's against fascism, no matter what tactics they're using, we can very quickly end up with some folks that are not fascists, but are advocating for some very, very harsh repression.
Well, or organizations like the Jewish Defense League, who is like really racist and really messed up, also really hate fascists. You know, I mean, yeah. And what's entirely ironic about this is for liberals, they see doing this as a way to combat fascism. Like all of these actions that are being taken right now, gun control, sedition charges, counterterrorism powers, all of this is an attempt by liberals to target the right wing, to, quote, prevent what happened under Trump. What is entirely ironic about that is they are expanding the very same apparatuses that were used by Trump to engage in the building of authoritarianism. They are strengthening those. They are expanding those. They are giving them more power and more resources. When in reality, what we should be looking at here is, if we fell into a situation in which the state, the controls that were supposedly present within the quote-unquote democratic state to prevent the rise of authoritarianism all failed, maybe the problem isn't just the right wing. Maybe the problem is the state itself. Maybe the problem is that there is a structure which is allowed to concentrate force to such a degree that authoritarianism becomes possible. Maybe the response to that shouldn't be strengthening that same institution. Maybe the response to that should be weakening it as much as possible. Right? This is what liberals do not get. This is what they don't understand. Many of them, I mean, you take the kind of Bernie Sanders type liberals, right? They dislike the NSA. They really love like personal autonomy and political freedom and also national health care and all that stuff. And they're sort of doing this kind of like reformist sort of libertarian socialist-y thing, at least in their own heads, right? That's kind of the politics they're shooting for. But their response to this has been strengthening the very same state that they're trying to get out of policing politics. They're giving them more powers to do that, right? Those same powers will be, if the situation is, you know, necessitates, turned against organizations like the DSA, just as it was the Communist Party. Like they'll be turned against us, right? Against the anarchist community. just like they're being used against the right wing right now. You know, we have zero reason to trust that that is not going to happen. We have every reason to be incredibly, incredibly, incredibly suspicious and very hesitant about things like this, right? That, again, as you just said, it's pretty absurd to assume that everyone that dislikes fascists are on the same side, because they're not. We are fighting a very different fight than a lot of the people that also don't like fascists, right? To the point where we are often fighting against other people that do not like fascists. And we have to be very aware of that. And so as we are moving forward in discussions like how to deal with what happened on January 6th, how to deal with mass shootings, how to deal with people that we thought we could trust going to work for institutions that are horrendous, right? We have to do something which has been shown to be somewhat difficult for some people at times, which is that we have to temper emotional reaction. We have to not be reactionary in our politics, right? Then it's pretty easy to say, oh, there's mass shooting, so therefore we should take guns away. Oh, people tried to do this thing that, you know, they were conspiring to like overthrow the US government, so therefore we should charge them with sedition, right? That, of course, to stop that from happening again, we need bigger, more powerful government powers, right? These are sort of these knee-jerk reaction positions, which a lot of people, even some people which consider themselves to be kind of anti-authoritarians, I have heard articulating recently. That is the result of not thinking through the implications of these things, not allowing ourselves to take the time to have nuance in our discussions, and assuming that there could be really simple solutions to really complicated problems. You're not going to stop the right wing through sedition laws and counterterrorism powers. You're not. Eventually, they're going to get good at countering surveillance just like we are. You know, eventually, they will. Not now, but eventually they will. And a lot of the impetus for that is going to be the disaster that was January 6th for them. They're going to learn that security culture is important all of a sudden. Counterterrorism powers aren't going to do much good then. If we really want to combat the right wing, what that requires is us to act. And when we act, we tend to get attacked by the state using the same counterterrorism powers and sedition charges and conspiracy charges that are used, at least ostensibly put in place, to be used against the right wing. They come to use that against us while we are trying to fight the very right wing that they are claiming to try and fight. Because at the end of the day, it's not about just defeating the right wing. For liberals, it's about the state defeating the right wing. And also defeating, quote, all extremism, which includes us. Right? At the end of the day, liberalism is a philosophy of the state. And its goal is to perpetuate the existence of the state. And very specifically in that narrative, to perpetuate a version of the, quote, progressive state. And they are eliminating all counter forces to that in this process. Maybe not intentionally, but incidentally. And so as we are talking through these questions with family members and friends and things like that, we have to be very, very, very clear with people that, yes, those are fantastically understandable emotional knee-jerk reactions, but they are not going to solve the problem, and they are going to land us in much deeper trouble. And if you really want to be an ally to the people that are fighting fascism and racism, you would specifically be opposing things like gun control, the use of sedition laws, and the expansion of counterterrorism powers.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us. And follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.